the side mission that you can do, but your home city is literally on fire right now. This is Up Up Down Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision. He's now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
We're also very lucky to have Scott Stevenson back, software engineer, designer, and longtime gaming fan. Scott co-hosts Low Earth Orbit, a fine podcast that reviews movies, comics, and games.
Hey.
Hey, Scott.
Good to be back.
Great to have you back. The topic for today is open world games, which is maybe one of the newer genres in games, if you can consider it a genre, but definitely something that has changed up a lot of the ways that games are built and the way that we play games and the craft of building games over the last, say, 10 years that the open world games have been with us. And to kind of start the discussion and start thinking about it and sort of that craft of building open world games, first question I can think of is, what exactly defines an open world game? Like, we can say, okay, definitely Grand Theft Auto is an open world game, and something like a very linear shooter, like Modern Warfare, is definitely not an open world game, because it's, you could almost just draw point to point to point of the triggers that you need to walk through in order to play the game. But is there like an explicit definition, or is there a continuum there? Is there a clear way to say this is or isn't an open world game?
What an interesting question. You know, I was just thinking about, I was running through some of the games that played my mind. I think maybe part of it is that, you know, if you have, let's say, you know, 2 hours of content in front of you that kind of constitute, I don't know, five different levels, if you have to go through those levels in a particular order and you have to like complete one before you start another, I think that's what I tend to think of as linear. And compared to if you can go through them in any order, or not at all, potentially, or start one, stop it, and then pick up another one, in my mind, that's usually kind of where it falls.
So the core thing is linearity, your ability for the player to make decisions about what he's going to do next, basically, or he or she is going to do next.
I think that's the roughest definition, yeah. I mean, a lot of it, I think, also kind of comes down to, you know, do you have such a thing as side missions? You know, can you go off and drive a taxi as opposed to saving the world, you know?
Okay, so I agree, and that sounds right. And then the follow-on question is the original Legend of Zelda an open-world game?
Interesting. The original? The way back?
Yeah, so like you start and you get a sword, and then you go around and you find various things. And I guess the core dungeons you have to more or less... you have to do them in exactly a specific order? At least definitely like Zelda 64 got to the point where you have like, okay, you need to beat these six temples, and sometimes you need to get an item from one of them in order to beat the other one, but you don't necessarily have to do it in exact order. Does that, when we say open world game, is that sort of in that pile, or is it on the continuum of getting towards that?
I think there's definitely a continuum. Most open world games do have some linearity in the main story mission, that there is a set of missions that you have to do in a specific order. That's kind of the backbone of the story, even if it's not, you know, even if there's lots of side content, even if there's more side content than there is main content, but that doesn't make it not an open world game. Something like Legend of Zelda, you mentioned specifically, I think falls into sort of that continuum in between of it's a fairly linear game, but it's got an overworld. It's got some kind of open world elements to it where, you know, where there are bits and pieces that you can do out of order, or you've got a, you know, a map that you use to get into the world that's more than just like a Super Mario Brothers style world map that you walk around and there's nothing going on it, but there's things you can do there as well. And that's definitely a trend in games that's been around for a long time. Like you said, all the way from Legend of Zelda, there's a bunch of recent games that have that going on. Like, I just finished playing The New Thief, and it's very much like that. Like, it's an extremely linear story structure. It's not even like open world style mission acquisition. Like, it's kind of very specifically like, okay, you're going to go to this area and do this mission now. But there is this open world hub kind of section that you can go and do stuff in and you know, and get to the missions that way. But I wouldn't characterize it as an open world game.
I think the fundamental thing that defines or makes me feel like I'm playing an open world game is the nature of exploration, of being able to sort of go around in a, you know, city or a town or a plains or wherever, and explore and find stuff. And that's sort of why I think of that original Legend of Zelda, because the first game, and Zelda 64 as well, is one of the first games that I really felt like I was exploring and discovering. And that's highly associated with being outside. Whether or not, you know, you could have a quote unquote open world game that was, I guess, in like a cavern complex or something like that. But generally, it's sort of associated with being outdoors, whereas historically, you know, most early games tended to take place indoors because, you know, it makes more sense why there's a roof and a floor and walls that you can't go through and things like that. So that's kind of what makes me think of it.
That's interesting because, you know, I'm replaying some of the Zeldas back through my head right now. And in a strange way, it might be kind of in the absolute center of like a linear game and an open world game, because you really can't, well, I guess it depends on which incarnation of the series, but in general, like, you can't play things drastically out of order, because a lot of times the dungeon you're in will give you something that will allow you to actually get to the next one.
Right.
But at the same time, yeah, you can physically go around a fair amount of the world. There was always kind of an element of like Metroidvania, where you could, you know, you had to knock some boulder out of the way, not until you had the magic, you know, boulder breaking glove or whatever. So in that way, it kind of prevented you from exploring the entire world.
But you could at least go up to the boulder and attack it with your sword and wonder why you couldn't break it down,
exactly.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Which, you know, obviously, so that leads into the thing that I think is the most interesting thing about open world games from a sort of game design standpoint, which is, how do you tell a coherent story when the player can quote unquote do whatever they want? And the answer is with great difficulty, right? you know, Grand Theft Auto and these sorts of games that have a kind of a very linear story where it's like, you know, guy rises up and gets pulled back into a life of crime, and then the stakes get raised repeatedly into the point that he's forced to do some totally crazy thing in order to, you know, get the government off his back or whatever.
And then he has to take his cousin to a strip joint.
Yes, or a pizza place and put up with his phone calls. In order to tell a really moving story like that, you need to have some sort of railroading where you have to do this and then this and then this. But, you know, definitely the open world nature of it, of being able to go and at least have three or four different missions that you can do in whatever order that you want, even if actually you still end up needing to do all the same missions, but it sort of lets you ignore one for a few, but then you're sort of forced to do it. If you ignore Brucey for too long because you find him annoying, eventually you have to go back and do his thing because otherwise you can't continue. But it makes you feel, it gives you this illusion that you're sort of crafting your own world.
And that's a thing that varies between different open world games. Like, I haven't played as much GTA as I've played Assassin's Creed, but Assassin's Creed in general takes the opposite view of that there's almost always only one major story mission, and all of the other things that you've got open are side content that's unrelated to the main story. I think there are a few points where it branches, but it's definitely not as branchy as the GTA games are. We'll often have plot threads with 2, 3, 4 other characters on the go that you're kind of moving along. And I think that gives them a little bit more power to make the world dynamic in the Assassin's Creed series, because they can sort of know, yeah, you're at a particular point in the story progression. So you can make some change to the game world and know, like, right, everything before this is going to be this way, everything after is going to be that way. But you've still got sort of that fundamental problem of narrative in open world games, that you have to be in kind of like, you know, a like weekly television series, you know, prior to the rise of modern sort of serialized entertainment. You know, back when you were watching, like, you know, the thing that I remember first noticing this was Star Trek The Next Generation, right? Because I watched it a lot when it first came out. I was sort of right in the, you know, target age, like late teens for that. And pretty quickly I picked up on, like, no matter how crazy, dramatic, over the top things happened in an episode, it was pretty much always back perfectly to normal at the end of the episode. And that's a limitation of the form, right? Before you had DVRs and you had people binge watching stuff on Netflix and stuff like that, you needed to make sure that the episodes of television series could be watched out of order. So you always had to return things to the way they were. And open world games have that same constraint that it's very hard to structure the plot in such a way that there can be big changes to the world, because if there are big changes to the world, you're going to lock off pieces of content that the user didn't know that they were locking off, right? If you say, hey, you know, you're in this one area and you've got some story missions there and you've got some side missions, but then when you do this one story mission, that place gets burned to the ground. Well, now you can't do those side missions anymore, right? And people will be pissed off because they weren't warned that they weren't going to be able to do the side missions after they took that story leap. And so you get these stories that tend to be very static, right? The world can't change too much in them, or it can change in ways that are very cosmetic, right? Like one of the things you'll often see is, and the Thief game, like I said, I just finished playing, has these sort of open world elements, and it's got something really bad that it sort of does that way towards the end game, of like the city's being taken over by this other faction that behaves exactly like the previous faction did, right? Like it's just the exact same guards walking the exact same control patterns, just with like a different texture.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There hasn't been any actual dynamic change in the world. It's just, you know, swapping the decals on the characters.
There's a point, right, in Mass Effect 2, I believe, where they pass a sort of a point, and actually this has become a really common thing in these sort of open worldy games, where there's going to be a point of no return where you go into like the final area where they really want to make the story linear in order to make it sort of entirely emotionally interesting or satisfying or whatever, the final part. And so there's this area where they build up like, okay, when you go on this mission, this is like the mission of no return in all caps. And like everyone you talk to is like, are you sure you want to do it now? And you're like, yeah, I mean, you've been just kind of willy-nilly going all over the galaxy. And he's like, no, I'm pretty sure if we're just going to like go down this one little path that it's going to be a really big deal. Are you really, really sure you want to do it right now? Warning, you should maybe not do it right now. And like, and then when you do it, then like half your team dies and all these cast drop things happen. Like, depending on how well you've done in the game. But it's a challenge then to kind of give that organic feeling that you're in control of what's going on while putting up these sort of warning, like, hey, if you burn this town down, you'll actually burn the town down and then you won't be able to do half the game anymore.
Well, that was a funny, and I had never actually played it, but that was one of the things that struck me about World of Warcraft, because they had that expansion pack that I guess tore the world
Cataclysm.
And I remember seeing the little intro video of that, and I'm like, wow, hopefully nobody was like in the midst of enjoying themselves in the original version of the world, because it looks like that's gone.
Guess that anyone who had a character who was like going up through the ranks, which by that point was most people were further along who were playing actively, but like you could have been in the middle of a mission and like, you know, saving this town, you know, princess or whatever, and then actually the town is completely destroyed and it's gone now next time you log in. So oops.
One of the other funny things that I've, you know, it's the nature of these open world games is that, you know, both the joy and sometimes the frustration is the emergent content kind of stuff. So, you know, in the best case, I'm playing Infamous right now, and that's Second Son for PS4, which is one of the reasons that I was interested in talking about this, is it's not drastically different open world gameplay than a lot of other games, but they it's so fine tuned, or so, I guess, polished approach to the things that we're used to, that I really appreciate. So for example, you know, they're throughout the way the city's set up. Have either of you played it at all?
Not
so
yet.
Far?
I played like 10 minutes of it on a friend's PS4, but I haven't played it. I played enough to like look at the graphics, not enough to say, gameplay's like.
Yeah, so one of the cool things, and I think maybe my favorite part of this particular game compared to other open world games, is that the story is basically there's this military government force that's moved in to kind of cordon off all the people with the special powers separate from the normal people. And they've invaded Seattle, and they've set up all these like checkpoints and towers and, you know, like hand scanners. And so what you're doing story-wise is you're trying to basically take back the city back without the segregation of people. But the interesting thing I didn't realize right away when I started playing, and it took me, you know, a couple plays to take it in, is that as you take out these sort of encampments, they stay away. They don't come back. So if you're up on one of the buildings and you see a bunch of troopers, if you incapacitate them, next time you load the game, those guys will not be there. So basically, one of the kind of side things that you're doing as you go through the city is you're taking out these encampments, you're taking out the troopers, and eventually you start to have this like effect on the actual like cityscape and the actual skyline, which is really cool, I think, because it's one of those cases where your presence matters, not like directly in terms of you beat the level, but you know, you're actually shaping the nature of the city, and it's not required in the game. I mean, you can certainly just blast through the game and just sort of take out the main guys. But it's satisfying because not only will it remember what you've done, but when you've reached one of these, you know, towers or whatever, you can take out that stuff any way you want. So if you want to go in stealthy and, sneak up behind somebody and just sort of incapacitate them, you can do that. And it's nice because it's not like you're in stealth mode. You know, it's not like the game is like consciously acknowledging the fact that you're in some kind of special thing you're doing. You're quiet about it. You take them out and, you know, nothing blows up and then they're taken out, or you can just go in guns blazing. But it's one of those things that's really appealing about open world games is that if you're given the latitude to take the situation out any way you would like, then it gives you an opportunity to be kind of creative as opposed to just, well, you got to shoot this guy this many times in this particular direction, otherwise you fail. You know,
I'm a sucker for that particular mechanic in open world games. It should become more and more popular of that you can go and do these side missions to like control the map or like turn it towards you, like in Assassin's Creed. They have these fortresses that are spread around the world, and each fortress contains a part of the map, or it controls part of the map. And if it's still active, then they'll shoot at you, and the enemy ships will go after you, whatever. But if you take over the fortresses, then you get free reign over the Caribbean. Why the British never take the fortresses back, I don't know. But and actually,
because video games.
Well, in Grand Theft Auto, like in San Andreas, they had that sort of thing where if you attack like the neighboring gangs and defeat enough of their guys, then you could take over their territory. But then you'd be off doing some important thing, like taking your cousin bowling. And on the other side of the map, it would be like, warning, some opposing gang, purple, is taking back over this territory. And you're like, I don't want to drive all the way over there and just like shoot more purple guys. Like, come on, I leave it alone. I take it over. So they figured out that realism is actually not worthwhile in that sort of
thing. Yeah, I saw there was something about the I was looking at a review of the new Spider-Man 2 movie game, and it seems like one of the downsides of these kind of open world approach, if you don't kind of tune it well, is I guess there's this menace system, which I was kind of struggling to wrap my head around, but the review made it sound like you basically are, you know, going through the city like you would as Spider-Man, just kind of, you know, running across people and crimes and whatever. And you have the opportunity to stop those crimes, or you can keep going because you're pursuing some sort of mission. But it sounds like, based on the description, I think this was the Polygon review, it sounds like what happens is if you see a crime in progress and you continue on, that's basically your docked points for being like a bad Spider-Man. So eventually your meter, I guess, drops off the bottom and the police consider you a public menace, and they'll just start shooting at you, which seems like, you know, independently, those ideas seem fine. But if, you know, I think somebody wasn't kind of looking at the big picture, which is that if you're just powering through the city, eventually just by like attrition, you'll become a villain, which seems totally broken.
Just from moving around. If you don't want to grind your way through these side missions and protecting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And making people do side missions, like that's a tough call to make and a tough pill to swallow as a user, because I've said before, like, one of the things about open world games is you have to be willing to find your own fun, right? Making an open world game isn't making one game that every person that plays it is going to see the same game and enjoy it. It's making like one game that each person is going to play like a different 40% of and hopefully find the 40% that's enjoyable to them. And if you make people do side missions, you're always running that risk of having some bit of content that hasn't been very well polished because it's in a side mission, or something that just gets annoying and repetitive because a lot of the side missions are the same content over and over again that you're now making people do. Whereas I think good open world games shouldn't do that. They should say, like, you have to do the main story, like, you can't get away from that, but almost everything else is optional, and you should figure out which bits you like and do those.
Yeah, and it's definitely important for you to give some sense to the player of which missions they will enjoy. And like generally the categorization of being able to say like, hey, this is a racing side mission. So if you like racing, maybe you'll like these side missions. That helps. But other times it'll just be like, there's a bunch of green dots, or like World of Warcraft, there's a bunch of golden exclamation marks over people's heads. And you talk to someone and he's like, hello, please collect 45 beaver heads. And then you just immediately close them and walk away and go to the next person. He's like, hello, please collect 18 beer cans. And just like, you know, if you could have some sort of categorization to give me a sense of which side missions I'm going to actually enjoy, then that helps a lot, I think.
Assassin's Creed 4 particularly does really great with that, I feel, because they make you do like one of each kind of side mission and sort of clearly telegraph, oh, you're learning a new mission type. And then at the end of it, like, all of them appear on the map in in the areas that you've seen, and they've all got their own icons. And so you can be like, yeah, I really hate those diving bell missions. I'll do the one, but I'm never going to touch that again.
They're pretty bad, aren't they?
Yeah, I didn't like the diving bell missions much. Or some of them, like the whaling stuff, I didn't mind, but it gets boring pretty quickly, right? Like you do like a couple of those to collect your gear up, and then you're like, yeah, actually, I've got enough money. I'm just going to buy the rest of the gear and not bother doing any more of those missions.
Did you guys ever play I think it was Red Faction Guerrilla. There was a game that was on like Xbox 360 and PS3. Did you run across that one?
Oh.
No.
It was kind of a sleeper kind of game. It was interesting though, because it was actually one of the more hands-off open world games I played for two reasons. One is that it had the spirit of, you know, you have, again, an encampment you need to take out to kind of win back. Actually, in many ways, it's very similar to Infamous Second Son, which is that you're trying to take back a district. And the way you do it is you sort of try to weaken the defenses of a bunch of the bases. But they let you attack those things any way you wanted. So if you, you know, drove one of the tanks, like you took over a tank and just drove it into the encampment, that's one way to do it. You could also, again, go in sneaky and kind of take people out one at a time. But the other interesting thing is that they had these incredibly destructible environments. So pretty much anything other than the actual, the landscape, pretty much any building or wall or tower or anything like that, it was pretty much all destructible. And when you took it down, you would collect these raw minerals that you could use to purchase other stuff. And it was actually pretty incredible how far they went with that. There is, to some degree, that they do have that in Infamous as well. In other words, you can blow up any of the enemy stuff. But you can't blow up like buildings because it's Seattle, and I think that wouldn't feel right. But the Red Faction thing was really interesting because it was incredibly flexible as far as what you could break down, and the enemies just did not give you a break. Like the AI was incredibly smart and incredibly tough, so you really really had to plan what you were doing. And there is some of that in Infamous, but not to the same degree. And I think I probably prefer the slightly lighter touch of Infamous, but it's such a unique experience because, like Nigel's saying, like you get to make your own fun, you know, because you may not always, every single day, you may not always be in sort of a story mission kind of mood. So if I want to go in one day and just kind of like, you know, mess around the city and do little side missions, that means I'm going to play the game that day, as opposed to saying, well, I haven't been in the mood to play this story mission for a week, so maybe I'll just forget about the game, you know, I won't come back to it. But if you have these little kind of outlets to do different things, I think it means you kind of keep going back to the game one way or another.
Yeah, Nigel's also mentioned before that one benefit of the side mission format for game development is that you can sort of parallelize the building the game more. So you could have like a small team of a few people working on the racing missions, and they don't really need to be interfering with the people who are building the main storyline, or vice versa. Like you can just have a team of some more junior developers building out extra side mission content without really much risk. And then worst case scenario, if one of the side missions isn't really working or it's buggy or it kind of gets tied up with something else, then you can cut one side mission from the game without really needing to change much. So it makes it a lot more modular when you're dealing with a game that has like, you know, a couple hundred to 1,000 people working on it.
It gives you that variability in length, right? That if you put the amount of effort that you put into something like GTA 5 or Assassin's Creed or something like that and made a linear game out of it, it would just be terrifyingly long. Like there's no way that anyone who had like a job could finish the game, right? Whereas by by having it that there's a, you know, that there's the split between content you have to do and content you can do, it lets you pick your length for the game as well, that you can say, yeah, I'm going to just blast through the story missions and get it done as quickly as I can. And it'll be like an 8 or 10 hour game, you know, same length as kind of a linear game, or I can sink 40 or 50 hours into it if I've got the time or if I'm really enjoying it or something like that.
So it's definitely a good medium for letting people change the length of their game. And pick the sort of side missions and things that they want to work on and things like that, and giving you more freedom. But what do you guys think of the ability to tell great stories in open world games? Do you, like, if you think of the most amazing or emotionally satisfying or even just fun or hilarious actual moments, not necessarily just you going off and causing destruction, which is of course fun and, you know, that's always going to be cool, but as far as actually parts of the game and interacting with other characters, do you feel like there's open world games that have done that really well, or is that still more or less the domain of the sort of Last of Us's and the BioShock Infinites and the games that are fairly linear?
You know, I'm just playing through some of the games in my head, and I think, you know, up until Last of Us, I think most people would have said that the GTA series was the only well-written, like legitimately film level well written game.
Really?
And Last of Us changed that up. You don't think so?
Well, I would say the original BioShock would be a contender.
But wasn't, didn't GTA 3 predate that?
Yeah, I guess it probably did.
Well, I guess, yeah, but yeah. So, maybe what I mean is GTA was the first one to sort of make a mark in that way and kind of say, okay, well, we've got big name actors. I can't remember any of the specific actors, but I know at least in GTA 3, they had some of those sort of film actors doing the voice acting.
Yeah, maybe you're right. I'm trying to rewind my perception of the way that I thought about story in games. And when I first started playing GTA, I didn't get play GTA 3, but San Andreas was the first one. It was actually the first, one of the first games, although maybe to some degree Ocarina of Time had some very original crystals of it.
That's true.
Of it feeling, yeah, like a movie. I'll buy that.
I think GTA came at an era where what was demanded of games story-wise was so much less that, yeah, I think it could excel even within the constraints of an open-world game. And I do agree, as with Alan, I didn't play the original GTA 3. I played a little bit of Vice City, and I played pretty much all of San Andreas. And they're definitely impressive from a story production standpoint, like the way that the cutscenes are kind of integrated into things, and the quality of acting and animation in the cutscenes is definitely a step above the other stuff that you were seeing at the time. I don't think they're particularly ambitious in terms of the storytelling, like the characterization and you know, thematic elements and stuff like that, which stuff like Last of Us. I mean, I'm sure there are other examples that I can't think of off the top of my head. We always keep going back to that one. But, you know, it's doing something more from a thematic standpoint. It's becoming more like a piece of film or a book where it's trying to say something. And I don't really feel like the GTA games do that in quite the same way. But I think once that happened in sort of the early days of cutscene storytelling in games, other genres pulled ahead of open world a lot faster because they don't have as many constraints. They don't have that limitation of needing to return the world to a particular state afterwards, or needing to allow things to be done out of order. So, you know, open world games now, I feel like, have fallen behind a little bit there, just because they've got more constraints than linear first person shooters or third person action adventure games do.
I think it also depends on we're talking about open world games as if they're a genre, which isn't really the case. Like if you compare an open worldy RPG that's like a squad or team based RPG, like Mass Effect, those are some of the more the best. They have some of the best opportunities for making you really care about a character, and then being able to give you some really emotionally interesting stories about those characters, because you're spending a huge amount of time with them, and it's very character driven, and you make some decisions, like fairly important decisions in the lives of these characters, as opposed to the more sort of Grand Theft Auto, or even worse, like a Skyrim type game where you're really just one person and you kind of mostly care about yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting. There were a couple interesting thoughts that occurred to me when Nigel was talking about a couple things are GTA, Red Dead Redemption, Assassin's Creed. I think, you know, it's really interesting. I guess it depends on how you're thinking about what makes a really good story, but I think the depth or maybe at least the breadth of things that they cover in those games push them into that upper tier of really memorable. You know, so at least for me, when I was playing Red Dead Redemption, the epicness of the story, you know, had an impact on me. If it was just like, you know, sort of unnamed cowboy running around shooting at things, I don't know if I would have remembered the game as much. But it's an interesting mix of linear and open world. I think there's definitely a story that progresses and you have to do the story missions to advance, but also you can play cards, you know, at a bar. And it's the same deal for Assassin's Creed, certainly the same thing for GTA. And maybe some of it is the quality of the acting and the production values are sort of, you know, I tend to weight those maybe a little bit more than some people. Because when I'm playing an open world game, part of the thing that convinces me that it's a real place is that the acting is really good. You know, if the acting is kind of throwaway, I'm kind of like, oh, okay, well, this is a fake video game, whatever. So I can't really believe that I'm there.
I would definitely echo Red Dead Redemption as maybe is the best open world story that I can think of.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because I remember reading an interview with Ken Levine, and he was citing Red Dead Redemption as like one of his favorites. And I was struck by, it seems like the Bioshock Infinite story was at least somewhat inspired by Red Dead Redemption, because they start off basically the same. They've got the two sort of, you know, gruff anti-hero guys who have a debt to repay, and their way to address it is to go on some mission for their creditors. Which doesn't detract from either one. You know, they're both fantastic games, and I wasn't distracted by it, but it just struck me that one little element was the same. The one other quick thing I want to mention was in GTA 3, I think I may have been misremembering when you guys were talking about GTA 3 versus Vice City versus San Andreas. I think I may have actually been thinking of the later games, but the very first GTA 3, I think the main character didn't even have a name, or like he never spoke, or something was anonymous about him, versus like the later you got into the series, participated.
Yeah, I think that's correct, that the protagonist in GTA 3 doesn't have a name. He definitely does. I can't remember Vice City. Definitely does in San Andreas. It's CJ in San Andreas. But I think I remember either seeing that from what little bit of GTA 3 I saw, or hearing that somewhere that the guy's nameless. Something interesting that you said that I think is a key point with open world games is I think one of the things that makes open world games really work is the setting, is the world. When they're at their best, it's because the world becomes this kind of character, right? That it feels like a real place. And the fact that it feels like a real place gives you these opportunities to make your own stories in it, right? That you can do something in an open world game that would seem much less interesting if we're part of a linear game, either because it's a very simple mission structure or a very small area, but it feels a lot more epic than it maybe really is because it's part of this continuous world for you, right? That you say, well, I'm going to go to this location and I'm going to get in these incidental fights along the way and I'm going to arrive at my location and then I'm going to take out the guys and get the thing and have to get back out and I'm going to run into this other complication on the way out. And so all of the pieces kind of flow together, and it's not, you know, at that point, it's not storytelling necessarily that the designers intended in the way that they sat down and said, all right, we're going to, you know, first we're going to show you this cutscene and then we're going to show you that cutscene. That's a story that you're making yourself. And that's, I think, the thing that's great about open world games is that chance for you to really make bits and pieces of the story yourself rather than have it all handed to you on a platter.
Absolutely. Yeah, I fully agree. It's interesting. You know, I guess in a way, the counterpart or the opposite of an open world game, but to me kind of fulfills the same sort of, I guess, like wish fulfillment, is the Uncharted series, which are extremely linear. But at the same time, you know, I think the part of it that feels familiar or feels open worldy in a way is the idea that, like, you're completely embodying this character. You know, in an open, true open world game, you're embodying this character and you're doing kind of side things, which is sort of more fully selling the idea that this is a real person. But in Uncharted, you know, you don't even have an opportunity to do that, you know. So even if you had the desire, you know, to try to find where the invisible walls are on the particular level that you're on, it almost feels like, you know, you don't even have motivation to do that because you're in the midst of, you know, dodging some Jeep chasing you down the stairs, or somebody hardly stopped shooting you long enough to even worry about that. So it's weird because it doesn't, in a way, it doesn't feel limiting. But even though you are technically still limited in that way, and I'd be curious what you guys think as far as, is the story in, like, the Uncharted series, do you find that more compelling than the story in, say, Red Dead Redemption?
I find the story in the Uncharted series, especially we were talking recently, the Uncharted games all have the same story. It ends up being like, oh, yeah, you're going to go and find the secret lost city of blank, and you're going to need the blank artifact in order to put it into blank slot in order for some other bad guy to appear just at the right second when you're going to put it in the slot, and he's going to try and take it from you, or he's going to succeed. And then you end up having some, you know, native tribe that's going to defend the artifact, and it's the same thing each time. And so the story itself, I wouldn't say compelling, but I find the main character quite fun. It's in his sort of sarcasm and sense of like, really, this is happening again? Or, yeah, you know, he puts the artifact into this giant mechanism that's existed for 3,000 years, and he's like, it really still works after all this time, like, you know, which is what you're thinking as a player and sort of breaking this.
Well, it's the same rules or the same kind of design as, like, an Indiana Jones movie.
Oh, totally. It's Indiana Jones the game, really.
Yeah, it's really strange if you think about it because, and this is, I guess, kind of obvious, but it went from Indiana Jones to... I forget, Crystal Dynamics, did they do the original Lara Croft game?
Yeah.
Where they kind of said, well, let's do this, but let's make it a woman. And then somebody in Naughty Dog is like, hey, this is great. Let's make it a guy, you know, but it's all the same mechanic. And, you know, even though I know that's going to happen, I still, you know, I'm still happy to give them my $60 to play it because they do it so well. You know, every single time I've, despite me knowing what the overall kind of design is of the game, the surprises are so good that, you know, eventually it doesn't bother me and I'm actually having fun.
Yeah,
so.
To me, what makes Uncharted great are the sorts of things that they do that you just can't do in a nonlinear story, right? Of having all sorts of crazy things happen and unexpected surprises and, you know, just nutty moments. Like, you would never have some of those, some of the great moments, like, you know, one of my absolute favorite sequences, even though it's practically a quick time event sequence, which normally I hate, is the bit in Uncharted 3 where you're in the plane and the, you know, like, the back blows out and you're crawling along the cargo canisters in the netting. And then they follow that up with a sequence where almost nothing happens because you're just wandering around the desert for like 10 minutes, but it's absolutely amazing because it's something that's so unusual for a game. And that's the kind of thing you just can't do under restrictions of story. You need to just be able to control everything that the player does to make moments like that happen. And so that, you know, that's where you got to pick the slider, is you got to say, all right, at one end, if we're going to control absolutely everything, we get things like Uncharted and things like Modern Warfare, where, you know, the player's on the rail, we've got control over everything, we can do these incredible moments, but the player can't feel like they own any of it. And, you know, put the slider all the way over to the other side, and then you've got the great open world games where you don't have a bunch of story necessarily that's been laid down for you, but you get to mix and match pieces in the way that you want to make it your particular story and customize it. Where I think games can get into trouble is if they try and mix them and pick the wrong mix. I've mentioned Thief a couple times, and it's one that I feel like does not do a very good job of that. Like, they clearly want to tell a a linear story, but it's broken up with these kind of open world sections between all the story missions that you never kind of know, like, how much of the, that stuff should I be doing? Do I need to be doing? Am I going to, you know, do I need to build up my stuff? You've got that sort of sense of false urgency of, like, the story's progressing, I should go do the story. And, that mix is just kind of handled badly in that.
The side mission that you can do, but your home city is literally on fire right now.
Yeah. Or like the new Tomb Raider game is the same way. I think we were talking about that exact issue when we were talking about it last time, is like, yeah, that this guy just crashed in the mountains and you got to go save him right this second. Oh, but you can also go into this temple and solve this puzzle before you go and save that guy, right? That in open world games, they've put things in place to try and deal with those problems, like to try and make it so that the sense of false urgency doesn't occur, that you always feel like, oh, I could go anywhere and I could do anything at any time. And if I put off the story missions, that's okay. There's nothing urgent. Whereas linear games that have these elements of open world tend to be bad about create the sense of false urgency and then undercut it with side missions. And that's a time that I think you can get in trouble. Or, the Zelda games are another example of a pitfall there. I played the original ones on the NES, like the first two, and then I took a couple off because I never had an N64, so I didn't play Ocarina of Time ever. And then I played
that's a major omission.
I know it is. I should probably like fire it up in an emulator at some point, or get, I think there's a remastered version for the Wii or Wii U now, isn't there?
Some totally legal and legitimate approach is what you're suggesting.
But yeah. I played Phantom Hourglass on the DS when it came out and enjoyed it, but it had a real, like, it was a linear game that you had to do a lot of walking between missions of the game in some ways, and you had to keep going back to the one dungeon, right? Like, you do one level of the dungeon and find out something that would open up something somewhere else, and then you had to get to there and you had to do the thing there, and you get back to the first dungeon and now you could make it to the next level because you collected the right piece. And so it was, I felt sometimes, not always, like I certainly wouldn't say it's a bad game, like it's well worth playing, but it had a little bit of that. The open world aspects of it were just kind of things that were preventing you from getting to the next mission sometime, like distance that you needed to travel that you didn't necessarily want to because you just wanted to get to the next story mission rather than there being a really rich set of content in the open world portions.
I want to actually talk about walking, so I'll do sponsor, and then I think that's actually an interesting thing. So this episode is again brought to you by Steam Clock Software. Steam Clock makes wonderful apps for iOS, Android, and the web. If you're looking to get mobile app designed and developed, and need a team who sweats every pixel, learn more at www.steamclock.com. So walking, it turns out, is not fun. I walk a lot. I like walking. I put in a good podcast and I walk to work and things like that. But if I'm going to go and sit on my couch, I don't want to walk. And World of Warcraft, especially in the early days, suffered horribly from this, where you spent like 80% of your time walking from mission to mission. The mission being, hey, go talk to this guy in this town. And then you walk there and then it's like, oh, walk over to these mountains and find, 8 fish heads. And then you walk to this guy and then he turns them into stew. And then you bring it back to the first guy. And like, you're spending a huge amount of your time walking. And definitely for a game in the sort of early generations of open world games, still sort of exploring that that genre and what it was like to just put someone in a real world where you do actually have to walk from place to place, that was a common thing. But the thing that I've really loved about open world games over the last sort of the PS3 generation, and now I'm obviously continuing on into the now current generation of consoles, is this realization that, hey, it turns out there's alternatives to walking, and we can actually give our main characters often sort of unrealistically good ways of getting around the world. So maybe that's as simple as John Marston in Red Dead Redemption can always whistle and his horse will be right there all the time.
Which is awesome.
Which is awesome and makes the game better. And it doesn't like make any sense. Like, really, like, where was the horse? I'm in the middle of the desert of nowhere. And I'm like, oh, wait, what am I doing? I should whistle. And then, okay, there's
it's a really, really good horse.
Yeah, it's really good ears and it's very fast. But that extends also to games like Dishonored is one where you can, like, warp around, and Arkham games where you have your, what's the bat shooting thing that grappling and pulling?
There's the grapple? The back grapple?
Is it just back grapple? That sounds kind of absurd, but the back grapple.
Is that the episode title now?
Yeah.
Back grapple?
Please email Dan. But that ability to get around in the world beyond just like walking and the sort of, I guess, driving in Grand Theft Auto, which is very like mundane of getting way of getting around. And I've really enjoyed that a lot. Or I guess in Prototype, the ability that you can like run up buildings and you can jump off them and glide and stuff like that. Like that's made open world games so much more fun.
We didn't have the like repeating glide mechanism in Prototype for a huge chunk of its development. And the dev team was just ecstatic the day that stuff went in. Like it was because once you master that, you can just get around on the rooftop so fast. Yeah.
It makes any game where you're just a human being kind of lame now.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that one of the things that Infamous does really well, again, the second son I'm talking about, is it progressively is the wrong way. It continually gives you new powers, and maybe a third of them are somehow related to traversal. So initially you start off and you're extremely fragile and you have a hard time getting around anywhere, but it's not really a problem because you don't have a lot of far off places you need to go initially. But one of the great things about, you know, actually doing the going through and finding the back pockets and picking up some of the collectibles and stuff is that it starts to reward you with being able to choose new powers. So eventually what happens, and I'm only about halfway through the game, but eventually what happens is you acquire some powers on the caliber of what you're talking about with Prototype. And it totally changes the game, you know, because initially you're kind of literally having to, you know, run around the environment. And it starts giving you these powers, and it's like that's a really great sort of reward, you know, for investing time in the game. I hear a lot of people like that about, I think, I forget which Spider-Man game it was. It was like, it's known as like the best Spider-Man game ever. I think it was like a PS2?
I think it was like Spider-Man 2. Not the Spider-Man 2, the movie Spider-Man 2, but
which Spider-Man 2, the movie?
Like Spider-Man 2. The second Spider-Man game that they made.
But it was interesting because, you know, you had mentioned Arkham, and the thing that strikes me about that example is the Arkham, the original Arkham game, which was set inside the prison. I don't think you could really consider that an open world game per se. I mean, you had some choice, but it was pretty linear.
It was another one of those like open world esque ones that it had a overworld that was more interesting than just walking from place to place, but mainly you were walking around between missions in it.
Yeah, and the thing that strikes me about that, and I think it's kind of a compelling sort of evidence for how great open world games can be, is when the first game came out, everyone, you know, it got fantastic reviews. But the thing everyone wanted, or at least the people I was talking to wanted, was, hey, this is awesome. Can you take this system and put it in Gotham so you're not stuck in this prison, basically? You know, so basically everyone wanted that same feeling, but they wanted the feeling of being Batman, where you're, you know, flying around the city and you're spotting crimes and you're, you know, kind of, you've got this sort of open-ended goal, even if you have a story goal as well. And the fact that they migrated from that closed space into Arkham City, is that what the second one was called?
Yeah.
And everybody loved it, and it got even better reviews, to me, is a very compelling, you know, argument for how great an open world game can be for a particular property. And, you know, the other thing is, Watch Dogs is, I don't know if it's out yet.
I think it's out, right, but it's tomorrow. As we're recording, so we're recording this on the Monday, we're releasing on that, so it'll be out by the time the show airs.
Yeah, and it's funny. I started off, they had delayed it quite a bit. I think they kind of looked at the game and, you know, it was supposed to be out like, what, November or something like that?
Yeah, it was supposed to be out for Christmas. And if if they decide not to release a game that's that anticipated for Christmas, you know that it's for a good reason.
Right. It's a serious deal, yeah. So, I had seen it, and I think I wasn't really into it because it looked like it was sort of the Hollywood over the top, wasn't even plausible kind of version of Hacker everything. It's like, I don't know. But the more I've seen about the videos around the launch, the more convinced I am that it actually is like a true open world game in the way that, you know, Grand Theft Auto is, but maybe even with more things that you can exploit about the city because you've got this sort of hacking mechanic. And I'm curious, I don't know if I'm going to jump in day one, but it's piqued my interest that it seems to have, you know, not just a city that you can play around in, but because of this mechanic they've got, you can actually control, directly interact with more of the city than you've been able to do in say, GTA.
Has there ever been a video game where the hacking mechanic wasn't just hilarious for anyone who's a software developer?
I don't think so. I think that's my skepticism with this, is like, I'm, you know, everything you see on the, at least the things I've seen on the trailers, are everything works perfectly. You know, all these city systems are beautiful and completely fault-free, other than the fact that, you know, they're hackable.
And but it's just the, like, nothing other is than the fact that you just need to line up green symbols on a black background in a line in order to hack them. But other than that.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't. Are you guys interested in that game?
Like, oh, totally.
Yeah. I'm definitely keeping an eye on it.
Okay. I'm curious to hear what you guys think once you played it, and maybe I'll give it a second look.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's one of the super anticipated games. It's probably, I would say, other than maybe Titanfall, the most anticipated game so far of the console generation. So we'll find out in the next couple of days. Like, I don't think you'll be able to not hear what people think about
it. Yeah, that's a good point.
If it's not quite good, like if it's not a sort of 85%, 90% game, then there'll be people angry or at least whiny about it. So by the time this show airs, people will know. But yeah, I'm definitely excited for it. So I'm looking forward to playing that one. I might pick up a PS4 in the next couple of months for that reason, as my sort of like excuse, because I know I'm going to buy it. So I might as well just get it over with and play it on there. So something I'm interested in open world games and in the sort of trade-offs in the way that they get built is the technical side of it, because there's a reason that we've only had these sort of GTA generation of games, and more recently in terms of history of games. Obviously, it's, you know, genres come and go, but it's actually really, really hard to simulate all of Manhattan. Who would have thought? And you know, that seems to be the cool thing to do, specifically Manhattan, or the sort of Batman version of it, or the prototype version of it, or the Grand Theft Auto version of it. So I was just sort of curious to ask Nigel of, and I know a couple of the existence, so there's at least a couple interesting stories about, you know, what makes it hard to do an open world game like that?
Well, it's the technology behind seamlessly loading the world is definitely the most gnarly piece of it, because it's this, you know, it's this extreme limitation, and it's a limitation on one of the slowest pieces of the system, that the disk is really, really sluggish compared to everything else in any modern computer system. And so constantly having to pull something off the disk continuously while things are going and getting it all into memory fast enough and getting it parsed and getting it loaded, and then maybe having to throw it away in a minute because they've run past that, you know, that's a huge challenge. And just making the world look rich enough is a huge challenge. You know, getting enough stuff there that it looks like a real world. I mean, if you go back now and look at some early open world games, they look really barren. You know, you can see like they just couldn't afford to put any stuff in this game.
There's three guys on the sidewalk and they're all walking with the exact gait at the same time. Their left arm moves up and down simultaneously.
and you've got tricks to work around that. I think I've talked about a little before, like the bubble of activity of, say, okay, we've got 150 pedestrians, make sure they're all in the player's cone of view all the time, because otherwise the world, you know, if we just scatter 150 pedestrians randomly throughout even this city block that we're in, things still end up looking barren. And so you try and concentrate stuff right in front of where the player is, but then there's a huge amount of effort in managing that. And there's the significant game design challenges related to like the mission structure. You know, if you've got multiple missions that can be on the go, then you've got very complicated interactions in the gameplay logic and way more possibility for game breaking bugs if you happen to do things in just the wrong order, and or just, you know, not even necessarily bugs, but just things that don't make sense because things are in in the wrong order, like that the story falls apart because you're referring to things that have already happened in, you know, in the future tense kind of things in side missions and stuff like that. So it's a, it's just so big compared to other types of game development. Like you look at these modern open world games and they've just got huge teams that, you know, Assassin's Creed is like 700 or 800 people, something like that, working on the last one. And yeah, it's a huge seller, but it's not like a, you know, 4 or 5 times better seller than some more linear game that they could make with 100 people or something like that, right?
Isn't it? I'm trying to, when they announced Unity, that's the next Assassin's Creed game, right?
Yeah.
They I think said they had 10 studios working on it. Does that sound right to everybody? Because that's the number to my brain right now.
Yeah, I believe that's correct. And that's not like some huge increase over the previous ones. Like I think there was at least 6 or 7 different Ubisoft studios working on the previous ones. I mean, they very heavily segment pieces of the production. And I can't imagine what the process for managing that production must be like, given what I know about working on an open world game with, you know, 100 other people all in a single studio. Like I have no idea how they manage the cross dependencies on something like that. It seems like a crazy project management environment.
Well, just give the boss battles to one other team. I'm sure they'll do it fine.
I can't even imagine the QA process, you know, for these games. It's just, you know, one, I think there must be some hilarious bugs they could file.
There's hilarious bugs that ship.
Yeah, well, one of my personal favorite stories of that is in Prototype, in the original Prototype on the PS3, there's one traffic barrier that you can pick up that will instantly crash the game. There was something weird about the way that, you know, it was like an older version of the object that had been left in and was broken in some way, just in this one spot. And they submitted it and it made it through TRC on the PS3. But they found the bug before the Xbox version shipped. And so it's fixed on the Xbox, but it was just like, yeah, Sony didn't find it in their testing and we're not going to resubmit at this point just to fix one crash bug, even though it's a 100% reproducible, you know, completely break the game crash bug. So I don't actually know where it is, but there's some traffic barrier somewhere in Prototype on the PS3 that you can just go and like pick it up and crash the game.
What game was that? That there's someone who had, was it Fez or Braid, one of those indie games where the developer had submitted it, it was on the Sony PSN store, and then he found a pretty serious crashing bug. He fixed it and he wanted to submit it to Sony, and they wanted another $5,000 or $10,000 to fully QA the game. And he's like, oh, it's just a one line change to fix this crash, like just post the binary. And they're like, oh, sorry, it's going to cost you $5,000 because we have to re-QA the entire game and run through everything. And so never got fixed. I mean, it got fixed, but never got shipped. And he was pretty angry.
Wow. Did you guys ever hear of, I guess I'm specializing in sort of obscure open world games, but did you hear about or did you play the game called Fuel? It was by Codemasters, so they did the Grid series, but it was like an open world racing game.
I've played a tiny little bit of it. I didn't own it, but I have played a little bit.
That was a really interesting game because the sheer, in a way, it was sort of a tech demo for, you know, their design, because it's just this incredibly unimaginably huge world. Like it would take you, I would have to go back and look at the details, but it was basically to scale the size of, I think, one entire state or something like that. So, I mean, it would take you a long time to drive from one corner to another. You know, basically, if you wanted to do anything productive in the game, you had to use fast travel at some point, you know, after you cleared one of the areas. But it's delivered on the promise of actually being immense. But the problem was is that there wasn't really anything in the world. So like you could drive to whatever your destination was, where the next race was that you wanted to participate in. And you could traverse all the stuff in between, but it's very likely that you wouldn't really see anything between, you know, destination, your starting point, your destination, other than sort of the procedurally generated barn or you know, whatever else had shown up. And it was, in a way, it was kind of fun to drive around in something that was so completely open. But it was also, it was kind of like the zombie apocalypse, you know, version of an open world game. And I guess it did technically take place after some sort of environmental apocalypse. But it was the extreme case of, you know, legitimately open world. Interesting experiment. I don't know if it sold very well, but
I don't think it did.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I've seen a few games. There's a game that's on Kickstarter recently that was, the whole idea was that it was like the size of all of the United States. And if they were going to literally use the GPS like topography of the United States for the game. And that's the kind of thing that when you pitch it, you're like, that is cool. And that's technically challenging. And that would be an interesting problem to work on. Okay. And then you get into the game and you're like, all right, well, I'm like in Idaho and there's no player within 5,000 miles.
Turns out it's more fun when you can sail from one end of the Caribbean to the other
in 5 minutes,
3.5 minutes.
Yeah.
What was the Minecraft project that showed up where they, I guess they had recreated all of the Netherlands in Minecraft? Is that what happened?
Did you guys be surprised.
There was something I would have to look at the details now, but it was something my almost certainly going to get it wrong version is someone in the Dutch government decided that the way to do this, or the way to sort of raise awareness on this geographical data that they had, was to use it to generate a Minecraft world that was like, I don't know what the actual scale is, but it was supposed to be complete in the sense that, you know, if you took one block to mean, you know, 3 yards or whatever it was, from that perspective, it was a complete representation of the country. I haven't loaded the game and I haven't looked at the details, but it seems like, I guess I don't know what to think about it. And it's like, is anyone playing that? I don't know. But I guess it's another version of that.
A lot
that
of those
idea.
Crazy Minecraft projects are not at all for people to play it, but much more for the, like, it's almost like sculpture at that point.
Yes, yes.
Awesome. So any final open world topics that you guys wanted to get excited about?
There was one thing actually that we passed over earlier that I meant to say something more about that maybe I'll bring up now, is just to call out how much better games have gotten at how they section off the world. You know, we touched on that in passing with the, like, oh, this area of the world's just too difficult now, like you know, the fortresses in Assassin's Creed 4, or the fact that you can go anywhere in GTA San Andreas, but if you go in a place you're not supposed to yet, the cops will show up at extreme power. You know, just in the Assassin's Creed series, you can see that as the first one was like all invisible walls. Like every mission, every city, as you progress through the game, there were always just invisible walls keeping you from everywhere. And now, like, the game has really been upped on that, on making the world feel a lot realer, and that you're constrained by elements that are actually part of the world. Like, oh, you can't sail to this area yet because the ships that are there will kill you if you do, or you can't get to this part of Seattle yet because there are these government checkpoints that you have to take out before you can get across to that section. And so that's something that I think is an interesting, you know, an interesting design challenge in those games it's always there, the challenge of how you section the world off, but that the last couple of games have really upped the tech on that, of how do we keep the player constrained for a while, like before we can completely let them off the hook and go wherever they want. There's got to be a section of the game where they can't do that because we need to teach them some of the rules of the world, or we need to keep them away from stuff that they can't do yet. So that's something interesting that I wanted to sort of call out.
Did you guys, have you played either Far Cry 2 or 3? I haven't played them, but I've heard different versions of what the game is. But
I've played
one version.
2. I think Alan has played 3, but neither of us have played both of them.
So did 2, well, I guess did either game have that concept of sort of natural barriers between sections? Because I kind of got the impression it didn't.
2 had one checkpoint, basically. Like, there were two halves of the world. So you were in one area, and then eventually you do a mission that sort of took you to the other area. And don't think you could go back once you'd done that. I certainly never did go back, and I think that's because it was impossible, not just because it was unproductive to go back. But yeah, it, within each area, you could basically go anywhere, do anything at any point. Like, it was very freeform, way more freeform than most of what we'd think of as the modern open world kind of games, like Assassin's Creed, GTA, Red Dead Redemption, those. Like, it was really freeform.
Yeah, that's the main thing that makes me consider going back and playing that one, because of the thing you're talking about, as I heard it was really that open. It seems to me, I remember reading reviews at the time, and it just felt the material was a little too dark, like thematically, for me to be able to enjoy it.
It is pretty dark, like, and it's a little thin plot wise. Like, it definitely suffers from being too freeform, that none of the content feels custom.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times, curation. They'd set up areas and there'd be like a mission in that area. And then later on, you'd get a different mission that was just like a totally different mission in that exact same area. Right.
Yeah.
Like the mission environments were just sort of sections of the world that were like a few buildings. And so, you know, you never had that. Even other open world games like will have these missions where you say, okay, I'm going to go to this mission acquisition checkpoint, and then I'm teleported to some totally different location that I've never seen before, that I can play like a completely custom mission
right there. Right.
And Far Cry 2, as far as I could tell, had almost none of that.
Far Cry 3 had the same thing where there's multiple segments, like it's on an island, and then at some point you end up going to the second island. I think there might be a third little island. And that's the sort of the way, and they have a fast travel, so you can always go back to the previous ones, but you can wander pretty freely and go off into random places that there's not really any point to be there yet, but you won't just like immediately die. There's definitely tougher wild creatures and stuff like that. But
I heard that was one of the, pitfalls, I guess from a user perspective, it's a pitfall of Skyrim, which is something I actually haven't played, but I when some of the people were playing, I guess, some of the beta versions, they would just wander off into the mountains and they would just stumble across like some gigantic Yeti, which would kill them, you know, one strike. And it was like, well, I guess I wasn't really supposed to be there, but, you know, technically you were able to reach there.
There was some freaking thing in Far Cry. I think it was just like a snow wolf or something like that, that I was like level 10 or 15 and I defeated many dragons. But whenever the snow wolf would come along, I'm just like, run away. It was horrible.
Yeah, the one other interesting thing I want to mention before we signed off was there aren't many games that actually attempt this, but I think one of the most technically challenging and possibly one of the most satisfying approaches is when an open world game tries to truly model an existing location. And Infamous does to some degree. I don't know Seattle well enough to say for sure if they're, you know, how precisely they're trying to model the city, but, you know, theoretically they are trying to do that. The other one that I have downstairs in my sort of stack of PS3 games I want to check out at some point is Driver SF. And I'm told that it does actually try to model the actual cities, the downtown area of San Francisco, which is interesting because I was talking to Justin about it, the co-host from Low Earth Orbit, and he was saying, you know, if the game is good enough, potentially you could actually learn how to get around San Francisco based on your experience in a video game, which is sort of an interesting, you know, way to twist your brain around it. But potentially, I mean, it's possible if the game's modeled well enough.
That sounds crazy, but I was talking to Dave Wiskus, who recently, he hosts Unprofessional, and he moved to Manhattan recently, and he'd played Grand Theft Auto and lived and breathed Manhattan in digital form. And so when he got there, he felt he could get around. Like, oh, yeah, it's awesome. That building. And that's, I mean, it's Liberty City, I know. And there's like a skeezy fast food joint there. Oh, there is a skeezy fast food joint there.
That's amazing.
I definitely found that Assassin's Creed 2, I had the easiest time getting around in because the cities in Italy that it was set in were ones that I'd actually been to when we went to Italy.
Wow.
So I knew sort of the layout of Venice. I knew sort of the layout of Florence. And I mean, the cities definitely don't match it super accurately. And, you know, they're a lot smaller and a lot blockier, but you definitely, if you learn enough of the city's geography from really being there, like I found that it was a help in navigating those cities. I felt way less confused in that game than I did in like the cities in Assassin's Creed 1 or Revelations or, you know, any of the other ones that weren't places that I'd actually been.
Awesome. Well, I think that's a good coverage of our topic. Thanks a lot to Scott for coming on the show again.
Yep. Fun to be here.
Yeah. So thanks everybody for listening. You can check the show notes, subscribe, or give us feedback at upup.fm. See you next week. Have either of you seen anything about this new game, Transistor?
I was going to bring this up. Yeah, that's the next on my list to play after I'm done with Infamous.
So this is the next game by the folks behind Bastion.
Great game, by the way.
Which is a great game. Supergiant Games is the name of the company. And it's I'll link up I read the Polygon review by Danielle Rindo about sort of the game. And the sense that I get is that it's has the same roots in some way as Bastion. It's still like isometric layout, sort of top-down action-y game. But the thing that I like the least about Bastion was the combat. Like, I didn't find it really that gripping. It was just kind of mechanical. Whereas, according to her review, the combat in Transistor is super fun. Like, it's just, you just want to play it over and over again just from the combat. And then it's also beautiful and engaging world, so I'm excited to play this, but it's PS4 or Windows, so it's making me itch to actually finally go and buy a PS4.
It certainly looks visually interesting from these screenshots here.
Yeah, there's a bunch of... I think Sony made a really interesting move with the pursuing the indie titles, you know, because I think that was something that wasn't really... I'm guessing a little bit, but I don't think that was something that was really on Microsoft's radar for Xbox One, because they had done this... I forget what the old name was for the truly indie Xbox games.
The Xbla.
Is that what it was?
Xbox Live Arcade.
Oh no, not that one. Like they had the good arcade games, which were sort of, you know, proven to have some level of polish, but they had something that was even more indie than that.
Oh.
Or at least maybe they were mixed together, but I remember when
I believe you actually now. I think that you say that. It's like if you go into this area underneath, you go into the basement and then underneath the stairs, if you turn on the light, you can find the indie games.
there was, I remember seeing, because you could tell, like, they were, you know, the games were of the caliber of, like, you know, shoot these seven cans on a fence, you know, and that was the entire game, versus something like Bastion, which is obviously a very meticulously constructed game. But anyway, so I think I got the impression, because that didn't really take off for Xbox 360, it seemed like Microsoft kind of decided that wasn't the way to go. But then Sony, at some point along the line with the PS4, decided, hey, there are these really great indie desktop games that maybe not everyone is aware of, or, you know, in the case of me, I actually don't have a Windows PC to play some of these games on. So maybe they kind of pieced together that there was a market here for this content and people that didn't have a way to play it. And they say, hey, you know, it'd be great is if we put this on our system that doesn't have that many games yet. And I think it was good. I think the gamble paid off, you know, because a lot of the games that people talk about are actually indie games on PS4.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of interesting. I mentioned Watch Dogs before, which is obviously a big AAA game, but this Transistor game is actually making me want to go out and buy a $400 console, which is, you know, in itself, I'm sure there'll be other games that I play, but, you know, their strategy is obviously working.
So, you know what I've been playing a lot of the last little while that I'm a little embarrassed about, but is actually remarkably fun, it's sort of unrelated to any of this stuff, is Plants vs. Zombies Garden Warfare.
I heard that was actually really good.
It is remarkably good. It's a huge amount of fun, and it's what particularly excites me about it as the parent of a 10-year-old and 8-year-old boys is that it's like a shooter that I don't have to feel bad about letting them play, right?
Which is, so by the way, the best send up of Modern Warfare that I've heard.
Yeah,
the title specifically.
Oh yeah, yeah. But I mean, even in terms of gameplay, like it's very, you know, it's very much straightforward, like shooter style gameplay. Like they got all of your, you know, base defense and team deathmatch and like all the various modes and stuff like that. But it's just, you know, it's plants and zombies, and it's got a lot of fun elements because they're not constrained by realism in any way. They don't have to say like, oh, well, we have to, you know, we have to get something we can sort of rationalize in the context of real world military capabilities. They can just be like, nope, this guy can just like dig into the ground and come up underneath you and eat you. Cause like, why the hell not? It's fun, right?
By the way, speaking of Modern Warfare, I think that the move to do to bring Kevin Spacey in for is it Modern Warfare? Is that the one?
Really? Yeah, the one that they just announced. I can't remember the subtitle of it, but the new one.
That's such a. I don't know what to think about the decision. I mean, I think he'll be probably very good because he's very good in whatever he is in. But it's just such a strange. I mean, I assume it's sort of a riff on the character he plays in House of Cards. And how he, you know, he plays those games and sort of like a nudge kind of thing. It's like, hey, you know that character who's in House of Cards? Well, this is sort of like that character, except he doesn't have the accent. I think it's an interesting move. I don't know.
Yeah, I was a little weirded out when I was playing Mass Effect and Martin Sheen was the bad guy.
Oh, yeah.
But I thought it was pretty awesome.
Yeah, but that was even like there was no existing connection with Martin Sheen in like sci-fi movies.
Yeah.
And the strange thing here is not even just that Kevin Spacey was in some sort of war movie. It's that the character he plays in another medium is into the type of games that this character is in. You know, it's sort of a weird Mobius strip kind of thing, which I'm entertained by.
I think that it will reach a certain interesting thing when a celebrity plays themselves in a video game, which maybe has happened, but I
think it's happened. Yeah, I think it's happened. I want to say like there was some... This is a horrible example, but the one that sticks out of my mind is I think there was some Vin Diesel like GTA clone kind of game that he played himself in.
He played Vin Diesel and he produced the game, and I'm sure it did great.
I think it was something like that. Yeah,
it makes me think of like sort of Family Guy in The Simpsons, though, as they have like guest stars that play themselves, and I guess part of the problem would be that if you're gonna have like, you know, George Bush in a, well, I mean, that's a really bad example, but like, you know, Martin Sheen playing himself in Grand Theft Auto, that like, you know, inevitably Martin Sheen's going to end up getting blown up or made naked or made, you know, various crazy mods. And you can see Ellen Page had a hard time with that, she was in a game that where she wasn't playing herself, but she was, did the voice for and motion cap for a character who looked basically identical to her and then ended up, having some problems with that. So
yeah, I guess
Samuel L. Jackson was the main bad guy in Grand Theft Auto San Andreas.
Not as Samuel L. Jackson, but yeah.
Pretty close.
I think the original I saw the Kickstarter for the like reboot of this game, and I had never played this game. I'm not even sure if I had a system that I could have played it on when it came out. But I guess Shaq Fu might actually be the original.
Yeah, that's a good point. Or actually, if you go to the NBA Jam games.
That's true. Yeah, I guess you could say sports games, you know, kind of win on technicality.
Yeah.
In all those cases, but.
Well, there's a difference in between the games in like, you know, the NES or Super Nintendo era where this blip on the screen is supposedly Wayne Gretzky. And then the NBA Jam where they have, you know, for its time, a fairly high fidelity giant version of Dennis Rodman's head.
I'm really curious to see what happens with it. It seems like such a bizarre. The last game I ever would have guessed, because I barely even was aware of it to begin with, was, I don't know if you guys even saw this, there was the Kickstarter project for Shaq Fu 2.
No, I didn't see that.
Which is the reason I actually even, you know, remembered it to bring it up now, was that there was some kickoff, you know, video that they had that had him in the situation where I think he may have even had a basketball and he was, you know, fighting ninjas. It's just the entire thing is so ridiculous. But I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Well, apparently it was funded. So they had a $450,000 goal to make Shaq Fu 2, and they raised $473,000.
So. Oh my gosh.
Wow. Isn't there something more useful that they could have been doing with that money? Like helping starving orphans or curing cancer or putting it in a big hole in the ground and lighting it on fire or something productive? Like,
I think they'd already done those things, so they figured might as well fund Shaq Fu 2.